This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad on Joy 94.9.
This podcast is presented to you by Broad on Joy 94.9 at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival. Broad presents Feminism and Publishing at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival.
We're going to shut the doors now and start. Please excuse my laptop in front of me. I don't have any ink in my printer and I'm moving house, so everything's a bit insane. Welcome. This session is on feminist publishing. Thank you all for coming. Of course, I first want to acknowledge that we're gathered today on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations and pay respects to their elders past and present and express solidarity with their ongoing struggles. Some housekeeping before we begin. In case you don't know already, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag FWF16. Please feel free to tweet, unless we tell you not to. sessions in this room will be podcast thanks to our friends at Broad FM. So if you do have a question, we would like to ask you to wait for the microphone so that that can be included in the podcast and audible to everybody. If you do have contributions, we are definitely open to contributions from the floor. We do have quite a big panel today, though, so please do keep contributions brief and to the point. Right. So, today we're going to talk about feminist publishing and the nexus between publishing and politics and hopefully break down some of the misconceptions about what it's like to be a publisher with a feminist agenda and also talk about the difficulties of doing that and the opportunities too. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming our guests today. On my far right, we have Marissa Pintado. She is the publisher for children's and young adult fiction at Hardy Grant Egmont. She works with a variety of emerging, commercially successful and award-winning writers, including Sally Rippon, Peter Hellier, M. Bailey, Melissa Keel and Erin Goff. In 2011, Marissa started the Ampersand Prize for debut novelists, which has rapidly gained recognition as Australia's leading award for unpublished writers. She recently spent a year in London with Egmont's UK children's fiction team. Marissa is also an old friend of mine and she is a brilliant feminist, so please welcome her. Next along we have Zoya Patel. She founded online feminist journal Feminazi, that's A-R-T-S-Y, in 2014, following 4 years as editor-in-chief of Lit magazine. She was recently highly commended in the Scribe Publishing Nonfiction Prize in 2015 and was the 2014 recipient of the Anne Edgeworth Young Writers Fellowship and was named the 2015 ACT Young Woman of the Year. She's also an inaugural ACT Stella Prize Schools Ambassador. Welcome, Zoya. And to my immediate right, we have Susan Hawthorne, who is a poet, novelist, political commentator and publisher and who has worked in publishing for more than 30 years. She co-founded Spinifex Press with Renata Klein and is English language coordinator of the International Alliance of Independent Publishers. Her most recent book is Bibliodiversity, a Manifesto for Independent Publishing. I think you can buy it downstairs. Yes, you can. And she has written numerous articles on feminist publishing and made submissions to government and free trade about free trade, copyright and parallel importation restrictions. Welcome, Susan. After those very long introductions, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephanie Convery. I'm the just recently departed deputy editor of Overland magazine and the incoming deputy culture editor of The Guardian, Guardian Australia. I'm also on the board of the Feminist Writers Festival and programmed this panel and was really excited to program this panel because I thought that we all would be able to bring something really interesting to this conversation. And I think we cover a really interesting cross-section of different kinds of publishers and publishing perspectives. But publishing, as everybody probably knows, if you're a writer or you're trying to break into publishing or you work in publishing, it's a really tough gig at the moment. And being a feminist publisher, in whatever way, is even tougher. The publishing industry has been in crisis for a few years now. The support for literary culture in general is declining, and particularly for literature writing art as a political project, it's becoming even harder and harder to kind of gain traction. I'm specifically thinking here of arts cuts and things like that, which have really taken a big chunk out of the literary industry in Australia, but also of things like parallel importation and the basic consolidation of media ownership around the world, I think also has a big role to play in this sort of thing. So market forces are a particular role in publishing in Australia and the world, and obviously have an impact on what feminists can do and what they try to do. So we'll come back to that, but I think I wanted to start with Zoya, actually, partly because you founded Feminazi in 2014, and that's only 2 years ago, and in a lot of ways it's never been harder to be a feminist publisher. What made you want to embark upon creating a feminist publishing platform, and specifically creating a feminist platform?
Interesting question. I think a lot of the forces that drove me to start Feminazi are really related to place. So I'm from Canberra. There aren't a lot of independent publishing platforms in Canberra, and there was no feminist-specific platform at the time. So I had just finished up with Lit Magazine and really wanted to keep publishing feminist voices. And Lit was fantastic, but just wasn't the right vessel for me anymore. So I guess I have maybe a young person's arrogance where I thought, if I build it, surely they'll come. And they kind of did. But I think I should also note that whilst Feminazi obviously does publish lots of different voices, we can only pay a token fee at the moment. And we fund it entirely through monthly events that we host and the entry fees from those events. So we're still very restricted in what we can do. And as a result of that, I do have to be a little bit more picky, I guess, in the pieces that we publish. So I'd love to see that expand, but as you've already noted, it's a really difficult, constrained time in publishing, so I don't necessarily have any huge ideas about how to address that.
What about it in terms of a political project? So you said, like, you have young person's arrogance, but if you build it, they will come. But what made you want to make it a feminist project?
I always write from a feminist lens, and I also tend to read as a feminist. And I guess I just couldn't believe that there wasn't something already existing in Canberra. I keep coming back to Canberra, and it's kind of ironic because most of the writers that we publish aren't Canberran, though I do try pretty hard to encourage more of a Canberra participation. But I guess politically, I just felt that there was a clear gap there. LIP was actually founded in Canberra in 2003, and it was aimed at younger women, so kind of 13 to 16-year-olds at the time. And it had a huge impact on me when I was growing up. I started writing for LIP when I was 15. And whilst Feminazi doesn't have that same young person target, I still felt that having something that was accessible, that was visible, and that was clearly located in Canberra, that was feminist, and that, you know, had a focus on dealing with gender and gender equality, and we also publish a lot around race and identity. I just thought that was really important. It just never occurred to me to question that motive, I guess. I just thought, well, someone's got to do it, and I might as well do it myself.
Susan, you've been a feminist publisher for a very long time and have probably seen lots of iterations of feminist writing and platforms come and go. I wonder if you could talk a bit about your experiences in that respect, but specifically regarding the concept of bibliodiversity, which you've written about extensively. In your book, you say, it's like biodiversity. It's not just about profits. It's about creating a long-lasting and sustaining literary culture. I wonder if you could expand on that a bit.
Sure. Thank you. The word diversity at the moment is really popular. Now, Renata and I were talking about this. Renata Klein, who's the other co-founder of Spinifex, and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. And we realised that both of us have been writing and talking about difference and diversity since about 1984. So one of the difficulties of being a feminist publisher, and specifically the kind of feminist publisher that we are, is that we tend to be a very long way ahead of the cultural curve. Now, that means we get to do things first, and then other people come along 20 years later and take all the credit. and generally don't even know that, you know, we've done it. So diversity, in fact, I did an interview about diversity just this week. And I, because of the whole thing around diversity, which I'm getting a bit bored with, not because it's not a good idea, but because it's being used as a branding thing, I did a count of our books, and something like 80% of the books that we publish exist on some kind of diversity spectrum. And, you know, that's pretty amazing, really, for, you know, a couple of white middle-class lesbians. But actually, the lesbian bit is important because when I was thinking about this also the other day, feminist publishers came into being because in the late 60s, early 70s, there were some fantastic feminist books published, things like Sexual Politics, The Female Eunuch, Feminine Mystique, less fantastic. But nevertheless, they were big sellers. But what was not being published was something other than big mainstream books. Books like Audre Lorde's Zami was published by a small press, Persephone, I think it was. Suniti Namjoshi's Feminist Fables, published by Sheba. Gloria Anzaldúa's Borderlands, La Frontera, published by Aunt Loot. Now, amazingly, all those three books are almost industries now in American women's studies courses. But they're all lesbians. None of them are white. Kerry Hume's book, The Bone People, was published by a very small feminist press called the Spiral Book Collective in New Zealand. Again, this book would not exist without feminist publishers. So for me, feminist publishing has at its root the notion of bibliodiversity, and that means that it has to be more than just equality for stardom, you know. I'm not into equality for stardom because that's a part of the capitalist project and a whole lot of other things. So what I want to see and what's important is to get the voices of writers writing from point of view of disability or class or culture or migration or from different countries. And so, I mean, for example, we have been around 25 years this year. And you will see, this is my promo moment, you will see our catalogue downstairs and you will also see our event, which we organised the date for before we knew about this, coming up in 2 weeks' time called That's Radical Feminism. You're all welcome. So we've been around for a very long time. And, you know, this is our life, our business, our philosophy, all of that. And there isn't, for me, any other way of publishing. So, yeah.
Thanks, Susan. Marissa, I want to move over to you briefly before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty of where we kind of cross, where all these different publishing areas cross and intersect and things. You've been a feminist for a very long time, but in your day-to-day life, you're a children's publisher. And while I think many of the people in this room would probably agree that ensuring kids are exposed to feminist principles from a very early age is probably a really good thing, particularly for, you know, talking about social and political equality in the future, and fairness and so on, I can't imagine the rest of the world necessarily agrees with this. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about how you negotiate the tension here. So you're working in a commercial environment, but you have particular politics. How do you make decisions on an editorial basis with regards to those things?
Well, for those of you who don't know, Hardy Grant Egmont is a commercial children's publisher, and we like to say that we're purveyors of stealth feminist books for children. I don't want to be difficult on my very first question, but I kind of disagree with the premise. We're a really small, independent publisher. We're not a mega publisher, even though we kind of sometimes compete with the likes of Random House and Penguin, but we're not a kind of purely independent publisher like Spinifex either. We kind of exist in a middle ground. And the reason I kind of disagree with the premise is because I work entirely with women, and all of the women I work with are feminist. And maybe that's a luxury, but I sort of don't think it is, because most of the publishers in children's publishing that I know are also women and have very strong kind of politics. So I don't think anybody, at least in Australian children's publishing, knowingly publishes books that are anti-feminist. In terms of negotiating the tensions, I think for me one of the most difficult things I come across as a children's publisher is this perception that there are books for boys and there are books for girls. Boys will only read books about boys, girls will read books about everything. And no matter how many times I have this conversation with booksellers and parents and teachers and librarians where they say, you know, I just wish you could publish more gender-neutral books, the problem is that that perception still exists, and that perception still affects our sales team, our marketing team, all of whom are feminist as well. So I guess, you know, that is a tension that we're trying to negotiate. I don't actually know what the answer to that is. I know from our perspective what we try to do is we both publish books that fit within the market. So, you know, the Billy B. Brown series, for example, which looks pretty kind of pink and lovely. You know, these are very feminist books. I mean, this book is called The Bad Butterfly, and it's about a girl who wants to do ballet with her best friend Jack, and instead of being able to leap gracefully around the room, she discovers that actually she's much more effective as a stomping troll, and Jack is the one who's the kind of graceful, beautiful butterfly. We also publish even kind of sparklier and pinker books like Ginger Green, Playdate Queen. This is called The Next Door Friend, and it's about little Ginger Green. Her friend from next door comes over, who's a boy, and he doesn't want to play any of her games because they're all girl games. And she basically, in very child-appropriate terms, tells him to fuck off because there are no such things as boy games or girl games. There are only, like, kid games. I mean, we also publish other books that are less overtly commercial and pink and sparkly and have more kind of explicit feminist values, and we do that really proudly. And now I forget what point I'm trying to make.
How do you negotiate the tension?
I don't know. I think, how do we negotiate the tension? I think every single day we kind of go into work and try not to publish books that are anti-women. And we also try to remember that, yes, young women need feminist books, and boys do as well. I think one of the hardest things at the moment is, like I said, that divide between girl books and boy books. But within the kind of boy book sphere, producing books that have, you know, visible female characters who demonstrate kind of feminist principles, because that's kind of rare. I think in the space of boy books, you often get casts that are almost entirely male with, like, one woman kind of in the background, and it's usually a mum, or it's, you know, a smart girl at school, or, you know, there are these stereotypes that kind of boy books like to feed into boy books. I don't feel like this is a very satisfactory answer. I think the problem is that it's really hard to negotiate that tension. But it's certainly not an in-house problem. In-house, we're all feminists and, you know, proud of it.
Coming back to the idea of a multiplicity of views in feminism and feminist publishing, I think it's kind of become a bit of a cliche to say that feminism is a broad church, right? But it is nevertheless true that feminism as a movement, I suppose, encompasses a whole lot of different ideas, different political strategies. We disagree on everything from the basis of oppression to what to do about it and what the ideal outcome would look like. This can cause a lot of problems, particularly from an editorial perspective. For example, Overland, where I have worked until yesterday, has very strong socialist roots. So as editors, we really try to... That really informs our decision-making with regards to pieces and so on. But at the same time, the conversations that we feel are kind of imperative to have don't necessarily follow the structure that would be ideal for our publishing, or for our audience, or for, you know, our particular politics or the politics of the publication. Neither should they. I mean, that's not how the world works, and that's not how you have debates about politics with people. But it does mean that you can often make decisions that you know, you intervene in a debate. I suppose this is more a non-fiction, around non-fiction, but it does, I think, hold true still for fiction and for poetry, that you can put a perspective into an arena that then... It could either resonate really well, or it could just tank completely, or it could create a massive fight. And these things do happen. So I guess I kind of want to talk about how you guys as editors and publishers navigate those choices. So how you sit there and go, okay, what kind of perspective do we think is appropriate here? What kind of intervention do we think is important to make? And how the responsibility? People see feminist publishers. People see publishers as gatekeepers. So I guess I kind of want to give some insight into the decision making process that goes on there. Open to anybody who would like to start. Zoya.
So I've been thinking about this a lot in the lead up to today's conversation because it's something that I'm really conscious of. And I try really hard. In fact, I don't think I am a gatekeeper of content. I'm a gatekeeper of quality. So I have, you know, my specific feminist views, which I've had for a long time, and they evolve and change. But I regularly publish content that espouses a feminist view that I don't necessarily directly agree with, or that takes a route to an issue that I wouldn't take myself or that I have contentions with. But the way that I see it is, you know, so Feminazi only publishes based on pitches. I don't read drafts, which is just a time thing because I don't have time to read a lot of drafts. So, but it's also proved to be very useful because when I was editing Lip, we weren't paying people and I would get a lot of drafts sent through. And because we weren't paying people, I didn't feel like I had as much of a right to say no. So I ended up often publishing pieces that I just didn't actually think were high quality enough and well-reasoned enough to merit being published. Whereas with Feminazi, I'll get a pitch through, and often I don't really agree with the assertion that's being made, but not because I don't think it's feminist or that I don't think it's valid, it's just not what I personally believe. And I don't think that's a good enough reason not to publish something. So I will usually work with the writer to make sure that they're taking a kind of complex enough approach to the issue. But for me, I only gatekeep based on quality. So if the piece is well-reasoned, well-argued, based on some kind of evidence, I will still publish it. And there's one writer in particular who has written numerous pieces for me now, and every time I get one of her pieces, I have to have these moments where I like take a deep breath and like pause while I read and don't get personally annoyed and, you know, argue back with my edits because I don't agree with her brand of feminism, but it's not wrong. And every piece that she gives me has research behind it and is structured and argued. And to me, I think that's a point at which if I wanted to, I could get an anonymous WordPress account and comment on her piece to have that argument. But, and I don't worry. I don't. But I don't think it's appropriate for me to censor her view. Because I don't agree with it. So, yeah, I see myself as a gatekeeper of quality, and that's a responsibility I have to my readers, but I also have a responsibility as a feminist publisher to give people that platform and that agility in an online space to have those discussions regardless of what I think.
What if she sent you something that you really believed was not feminist, but she believed was?
And, in fact, this writer is a good example. That has happened, and I have rejected the piece. But I always, and with any piece that I reject, except for like really just, you know, like somebody who's clearly sent out 5 identical pitches to different publications and doesn't know what we do, to those ones I send like a one sentence, no thank you, not that abrupt, but along those lines. But generally any piece that I'm rejecting based on the quality of the argument, I'll give a justification for why I'm not publishing it. And I will say something along the lines of, I just don't feel that this piece suits the ethos of the publication and the kinds of discussions that we're trying to have. So if you want to come at it from a different angle and re-pitch, then I'm happy to look at that. But yeah, I don't compromise, especially if I think that the content is genuinely harmful or is creating a discussion that detracts from, I guess, the kind of discussion that we're trying to have, which is meant to be inclusive but also challenging.
Susan, what about you? I mean, you at SpinFX published some books that have caused quite a lot of consternation in the feminist community over the years. I wonder if you could talk through a bit about what informs your process and the decisions that you make on a day-to-day basis.
Well, we publish books that we are passionate about, and that's an important thing. And there is a bit of a difference if you're publishing books as opposed to publishing pieces, because if you're going to publish a book, then you're up for a financial investment that is considerable. And so we don't publish books that we don't feel we want to put a financial contribution in over a particular issue or something like that. But we also have to love the book. But Renata and I made an agreement at the end that if one of us really, really, really wanted to do it, the other would not stop the other. And we've stuck to that. And we have occasionally disagreed, but we have always gone ahead. We have occasionally had members of staff who've really hated a book, and we've decided not to go ahead because of that. but we always have... we have good conversations about it. If there is a book that comes in that causes consternation or disagreement or whatever, we do have conversations, and sometimes they go on for weeks, and so on. So that's important for us. We publish books that are radical feminist because there is no space for other radical feminists to get published, basically. And in fact, in America even, we are known as the radical feminist publisher from Australia. You know, and actually we have a very good market there because of that, and because we are publishing into an area that is not supported by the mainstream, is not supported by the media. The media either ignores us or produces articles that are... insulting in some way, and so on. Those sorts of things happen. Some of our authors have been attacked for the kinds of views that they put out. Melinda Tankard-Rees is on at the Melbourne Writers Festival this weekend, and there have been protests. We had a protest in Townsville last weekend. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous, actually. And I wrote an article a few years ago called To Whinge or Not to Whinge. And at the time, the Age was looking for more women's, you know, content and more opinion pieces. So I sent it to the Age, and they refused to publish it. But their reason was, you'll cop so much flack. And I said, I don't care. You know, I'm quite happy to cop the flack, but please feel free to publish it. No, they wouldn't do it. It did get picked up by somebody else on a blog, and so. But there are things like that where you get punished or you get silenced or you get ignored in various ways, and that can be very difficult because it's really hard to get books reviewed if they're not offered to reviewers. I mean, there are probably fantastic reviewers here in this room, but I don't know if you ever are sent copies of our book. Please contact us if you would like to review our books and have a place to publish that. You know, we're always looking for great reviewers. So I think there are certain kinds of feminist voices that are allowed in the media, and some of those get a good run. But even, I mean, as Clem said, you know, she also cops it. And Jenna as well. You know, I mean, you do cop it almost no matter what you do. But it's very hard to get a radical feminist voice into the media.
Marissa, how does this manifest when you're trying to assess whether a manuscript, a children's book or, a children's book in your case, is a project that you think is worth investing in? I mean, I can imagine that it would be a much less straightforward project with fiction than it would necessarily be with an opinion piece.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think I agree with Zoya that we're really gatekeepers of quality, more so than sort of political gatekeepers. But then having said that, I feel like children are... they're not just susceptible, obviously, to the messages in books. They're susceptible to messages through every which way, you know, through TV, through film, through toys, through the girls' aisle at Toys R Us, which is just a sea of pink and glitter. Not that there's anything wrong with pink and glitter, but there is a problem when you don't have any other options as a girl child to, play with a toy that doesn't kind of fall into that. For us, Hardy Grant Egmont is kind of small enough that we don't have to worry about publishing to a quota, but we are small enough that I need to love every single book that we publish because I work on every single book that we publish. And I just don't have the stomach to work on something and read a manuscript kind of upward of 20 times if I don't agree with the politics of it. So I guess for us it is crucial that every book we publish, you know, models and promotes feminism. Like I said, whether it's implicit or explicit, whether it's a book that's more targeted towards young girls, whether it's a book that's more targeted towards young boys, whether we manage to get around that kind of categorization regardless. But I mean, we do obviously focus on the story and the narrative, the quality of the narrative first and foremost. But I guess the acceptability of the politics to us is pretty key.
Are any of you ever tempted to? I mean, there are particular views, and sometimes you can see a particular intervention or a particular narrative that might bring about more attention or get more attention for the publishing house or the magazine or masthead or whatever. Are you ever tempted to just take those and run with them because you know that they will either bring, like, they will sell like hotcakes, or they will, you know, result in a high level of readership? Yeah, and I'm thinking because of the tension between commercial concerns, like everyone here is working for an outfit that has to engage with the financial realities of, you know, of running a business in some respect, whether it's not-for-profit or whether it's a commercial enterprise. So, I mean, it can be really tempting to say, oh, well, we'll take that piece because it'll troll whoever, or it will, you know, incite debate in a way that's going to mean lots of clicks. How do you deal with that temptation, I guess?
We thought about this long and hard around about 2000 or thereabouts, and our answer was to publish books about women and animals. So we have a book called A Girl's Best Friend about women's the meaning of dogs in women's lives, Cat Tales, the meaning of cats in women's lives, and Horse Dreams, the meaning of horses in women's lives. And these books were fabulous, and they sold lots. But we discovered that women who have horses are in horse book clubs. And so you can sell a lot of copies to the horse book clubs, the equestrian clubs. Cat women do not ever, ever belong to a book club about cats. And dog women are somewhere in between. but we copped a lot of flack when we first published we were talking to potential contributors at Frankfurt Book Fair, and some of them said, but what about cats? We said, okay, we'll do that next. So we kind of we did have a lot of ideas about, you know, where else we might go after dogs, cats and horses, but actually they were also quite expensive to produce because they got beautiful photos, and we spent the night at the printers and oversaw the public, you know, the printing of it, and so it was also very exhausting. But you know, we love those books just as much as we love our animals.
I have a cat and a horse, so I have to go look up those books. I have this problem more with curating events than I do with publishing pieces because of the model that we use at Feminazi, where the more people I can get into an event, the more pieces I can publish that month. So I actually make a point of not publishing for controversy's sake on Feminazi, because part of the ethos of the publication is also to be accessible to the men and women who, because I actually find that most women are quite open to Feminazi's content, but I am trying to kind of sneakily bring feminism to men as well by kind of hiding the vegetables inside more appetizing content. So I try not to rely on that kind of controversial content, because I really want it to be a space that people come into and then find themselves maybe becoming feminists without realizing. But certainly
at a publication called Feminazi.
artsy, not Nazi. But with the events, I do often shamelessly curate people who are popular in Canberra for various reasons, even if I know that they're not going to be particularly great speakers, or I couldn't care less about, I mean, I do care about all of our speakers and their stories, but yeah, I have erred on that side. And I also curate themes for events that are like, just, you know, I had advice to my teenage self recently, that was packed. Don't really care too much about the theme, but I know that there are crowd pleasers for that kind of content. And I usually publish those transcripts online as well, which is partly just kind of filling content gaps because the speakers are paid to also have their piece published. But I think there's nothing wrong with occasionally curating for a specific outcome in terms of content, but as a feminist publisher, we do still have a mandate to publish pieces that we believe in and that kind of have a political stance that we can agree with. So, yeah, it's just balancing the two.
We're doing something very radical next year. We're publishing a book called The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men by a Man. So we'll see whether that sells. Please buy one for all the men you know.
That sounds awesome.
Marissa?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we do court authors with profile because a pretty big problem for us in publishing is discoverability and, you know, finding authors with a large enough profile that they can market themselves and find readers. And I mean, we're in the business to sell books, we're in the business to make money for ourselves, and more importantly, we're in the business to make money for our authors, because I think artists who are able to make money from their art is, you know, that's kind of a rare thing. I think where we do succumb to the temptation, such as it is, to kind of be a bit kind of crass and commercial is with packaging. And, you know, I think it's most an issue for publishing for little girls or books with little girl protagonists because they are, for whatever reason, whether it's kind of influence in the schoolyard, whether it's the media, whether it's just personal taste, they are inevitably at some point, well, not inevitably actually, but often drawn to the pink and the glittery. So our approach to that is to sometimes give them the pink and the glittery and just to make sure that the content is as nutritious as it can possibly be. We call it muesli dressed up as Cocoa Pops. And yeah, I mean, and sometimes that means books in which, you know, the cover is pink and glittery and we actively kind of have a very feminist plot line in which, you know, a feminist dilemma is put to our, you know, girl protagonist and she must step up and attack it and correct the incorrect views of whoever her antagonist is. And sometimes it's simply just that we have young girls in positions of agency and, you know, behaving like kids in whatever way is appropriate.
Does anybody have any questions at this stage? Enzo?
Thank you. A couple of you mentioned quality as the key thing. And I'm really interested in this judgment of quality because I don't think it's an objective judgment. And that often that means that we have a kind of, you know, we have a Western white literary tradition and we judge quality based on that. And also, you know, when we get a Miles Franklin shortlist with all men and women complain, then the response is always, well, the best books got shortlisted. Or when you look at reviews and there's only men's books being reviewed, the male reviewers say it's the best books were reviewed. So I just wanted, I guess, for you guys to sort of respond to that question of quality.
I don't claim to have an objective view of quality at all. One of the cool things about starting your own publication is that you get to make all the calls and no one gets to necessarily, you know, question that. I do, however, as Feminazi has grown, so when it first launched, it was only me editing the pieces and kind of triaging the submissions that we got. And as it has grown and it's taken on a life of its own, I have put in some mechanisms to try and hold myself accountable and not allow my dictatorial kind of tendencies to take over when I am assessing quality. So I have an assistant editor, a features editor, and sometimes if I think a piece is just rubbing me the wrong way, I'll get somebody else to read it. But we also have criteria that each article must meet. So some of the things I mentioned earlier being somewhat evidence-based. Obviously, we publish a lot of memoir and fiction, so same criteria don't necessarily apply, but having a well-reasoned argument and just not relying on stereotypes or blanket statements are the main things. But I do I do kind of take your point around this idea of quality as being this intangible thing that we use as a, you know, we rely on it sometimes to justify publishing decisions. And I don't know that I really have enough experience to have a response to how to deal with that. So I'm hoping Susan can shed some light.
Well, for me, quality is what you finally produce. And I think the important thing as a publisher and an editor is that you're able to see how something will be when it's the finished book. So, I mean, we've often worked with people who are writing as first-time writers or who are writing as people who are speaking English as a second or third or whatever language, or who are coming from a very different cultural background. And the important thing for us is that we can publish those books in the best quality that we can, and that involves respecting the author sufficiently to challenge her on the work that they've done. And that doesn't mean, you know, going in like a bulldozer. In fact, it's much more important to support a writer, but to push them with interesting and worthwhile questions to say what it is they really mean, or to turn our first novel into a book that's a bit wobbly and not quite interesting at the beginning, and, you know, allow the writer enough time to rework it. Or with a poetry book, to find, we've had a couple of very fine poetry editors who are able to make really good subtle suggestions to poets, because if you tell a poet, oh, look, you cut that line out, often the whole poem falls apart. You can't do that. So the poet has to be able to respond and, you know, say something like, lift that word. This is something said to me by a poetry editor, by Geordie Albiston, actually. Lift that word, it's not working. Or this poem doesn't work. Can you have another look? Or can you find a different word or a different... Can you turn this line around? You know, those sorts of things are actually really useful for the writer. So I think that having that kind of view of quality is what matters to me. And then also having beautiful covers and well-typeset books and nice paper and, you know, those sorts of things, and paper that is, you know, the FSA paper and all of those things. You know, for me, that's what quality is about.
Yeah, I am... It is absolutely subjective. I mean, we spend a lot of time, I think our marketing exec is in the room as well. I think we spend a lot of time checking our privilege, particularly around representations of race in our fiction, because we have a couple of series on our books at the moment where the kind of titular character is non-white and the writer is white. And so you spend a lot of time kind of going, well, you know, I may not find this particular representation problematic, but I'm a middle-class white lady. So, you know, that's definitely a point at which we go and seek other opinions. We've just published a book called The Writers of Thunder Realm, which is the first in a series called Paladero, and one of the main characters is trans. And we did a lot of kind of discussion and negotiation around that with the author and with Transgender Victoria to make sure that even if the protagonist of the novel is sometimes kind of confused about what trans is, the novel itself is never confused about what trans is. That to us was a really important distinction and was really important to the author to get right, because he is a cisgender, hetero, white, privileged male as well. So yeah, I mean, I know that there are definitely limitations. I think that there are areas that many editors I know would really like to be better equipped to edit, for example, Indigenous writing. I think we all come from, most of the women I know who are editors are white and come from very privileged backgrounds and haven't had nearly enough exposure to those kinds of stories. But, you know, I think in instances where at least we're checking our privilege and we can kind of rely on the author themselves to do a little bit of that work and So, for example, we just published a book called Bro by a Syrian-Australian woman called Helen Chibet. And the vernacular in that novel is... it's set in a Lebanese kind of Australian community, and as a kind of white woman, I really wanted to take out all of the gunners and shooters and, you know, every time one character called another character a dog, I was like, oh, that's so on the nose. And I really kind of relied on her to tell me when it was, when I was making that as an editorial kind of suggestion and when I was just making those suggestions as somebody who was not from that kind of subculture. So I don't know. It's a constant process of negotiation for us as well.
I just wanted to add to that. Certainly at Overland, one of the things that we do is, I mean, we talk about almost every submission, but we kind of have two markers for quality. There's people who write really well by the line, and then there are people who make a really interesting argument. And one of the questions we often ask ourselves is this argument a constructive argument to make? Is this an intervention that we think is useful at this time? But certainly for fiction and poetry, we have a whole suite of readers who will also... So if you submit to Overland and you submit fiction or poetry... If you get to the actual fiction or poetry editor, you will have gone through a couple of rounds of reading from our like pool of readers who know the Overland, you know, aesthetic and kind of the objectives of the magazine. So there are a number of people who sort of sit there and go, "Well, is this a piece that, you know?" And if there's dissent in there, it gets a third reader. So we do have checks and balances on quality and things like that. Obviously, like, everyone makes mistakes, but sometimes, particularly if you're working with emerging writers, I think it's important to understand that there are, on both of those levels, on the level of line by line writing and on the level of like making an argument, those things take practice. So you have to kind of, as an editor, you have to give those people space to sort of space to practice and to kind of flourish in that. So somebody could be making a really writing really beautiful prose, but their argument might be a bit flat, or they could be writing, you know, their prose could be quite green, but the argument could be a really interesting take. So it's a constant balancing act, I think, about those things. And again, talking to other people, talking to other editors about your thoughts about those things can really help clarify whether you think this is a good decision or not. We probably have time for one more question if anyone's got it, but it'd have to be really quick. No? Okay. Oh. Very quick.
I just wondered if the panel could comment on the state of feminist publishing as you see it now.
I think the important thing about feminist publishing is that when I first moved into publishing, and I worked at Penguin for 4 years before Renata and I set up Spinifex, at that time there was a very vibrant feminist publishing and bookselling world. It was the era of the International Feminist Book Fairs, one of which I organised, and along with Renata, and Renata was involved in the one in London in 1984. So there was a really vibrant international feminist publishing scene. Borders came along in the US and they killed off almost all of the feminist bookstores in America. There were about 100 to 200 of those. That meant that feminist publishers didn't have booksellers who were loyal orderers of their books, so that killed off a lot of feminist publishers. And what I think is important is to be developing a community of feminist publishers, writers, editors, booksellers. So, because, I mean, as one small publisher, we can't publish everything. You know, it's just impossible. And so we say no more often than we say yes. And my ideal world would be where there were lots of feminist publishers, because then, you know, feminist publishers would be able to do what we did back in the 90s, which is have a whole row of... was called the Feminist Lesbian Gay Publishers section of the Book Expo America. And the booksellers all met one day and the publishers met. And so we talked to one another over the 5 days of the fair. That, to me, is fantastic. And the feminist International Feminist Book Fairs, that was where in Barcelona I learned how to sell international rights. I went along and I had one book and that I was at Penguin at the time. And I said to a friend, I said, what do I do? And she said, well, sell me the book. And so she was from the Women's Press, and so I sold her this book. It was called Take the Chook, actually. And she was Australian, so she was on site. She said, you know, we're going to have to change that title. Nobody in England will understand it. But that was my first lesson in selling international rights. I couldn't have done it without that. So feminist publishing, I think, has potentially a fabulous future, but we need more of us. We need many, many more of us. And, yeah, that's probably...
Support your local feminist publishers. thank you very much for being such a great audience. Please thank Marissa, Zoya and Susan for being such great panellists. The next thing in this room is Feminism Through Fiction, which will dovetail quite nicely with what we've been talking about. So
I forgot to mention that if you want to read Bibliodiversity, you can read it in Arabic and French and English.
Thanks, guys.
This has been a special broadcast from Broad at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival on Joy 94.9.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune into us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy for feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.